The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, readers. Welcome. I'm Lynn Rosen, a friend of the Free Library of Philadelphia, and I have loved Alice McDermott for so long. I first loved A Bigamist Daughter when I encountered her in 1982. I loved her through That Night in 1987. I loved her at Weddings and Wakes and through Charming Billy. But when I really fell hard was when Someone came along in 2013. Marie's story captured my heart. I had the opportunity then to correspond with the author when she agreed to answer questions for a Q&A for my bookstore customers. "You have written one of those wonderful novels," I wrote her, "where it seems like so little happens, and yet it packs such an emotional punch." She politely but firmly disagreed. "I think that quite a lot happens in this book," she told me. I took another look and saw that Marie's meandering story, in fact, touches on nearly every important historical event in the 20th century. She is that kind of writer, a writer with a powerful gift for memorable and meaningful storytelling. And now Alice McDermott has given us Absolution, her ninth novel, which she will be discussing this evening in conversation with Nomi Eve, author of Henna House and The Family Orchard and director of the MFA in Creative Writing at Drexel University. About Absolution, it makes me ask, how do we find our way in a troubled world? How do we bump up against history and make meaning? Maybe we need to look at those on the periphery of history and, as Abigail Adams admonished us, remember the ladies. Please join me in welcoming Alice McDermott and Nomi Eve.
Hello, wonderful people. It is just such a pleasure to be here tonight in conversation with Alice McDermott about her wonderful new book, Absolution, which is up here with this gorgeous title, cover, and to ask Alice some questions, and I'm excited to hear her answers, and we'll chat for around half an hour, and then we'll do a Q&A and have time for your questions. So if you think of something as we're talking, just save it, and we'll get to you. And I am going to start with, can we talk about Barbie? And here is my Barbie question.
Okay.
The women in your novel dress Barbies up in traditional Vietnamese clothing and then sell the dolls to other American women to raise money for the charity work they're doing on behalf of Vietnamese women and children. There are so many layers here that we could delve into. What I'm wondering about is this. Barbie has marched on her plastic tippy toes back into popular culture lately. And I'm guessing that when you were writing this book, you chose Barbie for similar reasons that Margot Robbie did when she acquired the Barbie IP from Mattel. She is a potent carrier of women's own ideas about themselves. And this would have been as true for your characters, Trish and Charlene, as for women today, dressed up in pink, going to see that movie. Can you just talk to us a bit about Barbie and how she walked onto the pages of your book and what it felt like to know that your book was coming out and Barbie also had a coming out of sorts? Now, so if we could just chat about Barbie.
Great. I'd love to chat about Barbie. Yeah, who knew? I didn't know. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's a great place to begin. I guess I have to do a nod to my literary roots first to get back to Barbie. One thing that sort of was a long time brewing idea or objection, I suppose, that inspired this novel was the first time I read Graham Greene's The Quiet American as an undergraduate at Oswego State, coldest college campus in the country on the shores of Lake Ontario. And I remember reading The Quiet American and being amazed at how smart Graham Greene was about what was coming for America in Southeast Asia. The novel was published in 55 or 56, and yet he saw, and I'm reading it in, you know, the early 70s, and he saw all the missteps. But he did not see what was coming for women. Mm-hmm. And the women in the novel are silly, you know. The one Vietnamese character is like a doll, a dress-up doll, if you will. Mm-hmm. And there was one scene in which the narrator, the hardened British journalist, looks over. He's sitting in a milk bar, and he looks over, and he sees two young American girls, kind of college girls, finishing up their ice cream. And he thinks about how clean and uncomplicated they look, and you can't imagine them having any passions or the sweat of sex or having anywhere near as complicated a life as he has. And even as a 19-year-old, I thought, that's not right. That can't be. What are these two young American women doing in Saigon in 1955? Mm-hmm. They're really interesting. I would love to know how they ended up there. And I, you know, I've read the novel many times since. I've taught it, but it was always, they just have two pages in which these girls appear, and yet they should not have been dismissed. So fast forward, I've spent the last 30 years living inside the Beltway, outside D.C., and time and again, I would run into women socially, through church, through carpool lines when my kids were in schools, many of them grandmothers picking up grandchildren, and discover that these are women who might have been the models for those two uncomplicated women with fascinating histories, who had worked for the Foreign Service, the State Department, who were military wives, you know, who had done all kinds of things, lived all over the world, and just were going about their ordinary lives. In one of these conversations, a woman I knew, you know, sort of the generation ahead of mine, talked about being with her husband in Saigon in the early 60s. And she said, you know, we did a lot of good do-gooding stuff. She was sort of tongue-in-cheek. We were trying to be do-gooders. And we sold little Barbie clothes, little Ao Yais, the traditional dress. And when she said this, I had, you know, as it happens, I tapped into this memory. And I said, when I was a kid, I played with a girl who had a Barbie in one of those outfits. So it's that sort of, I think, you know, all of us who love stories, that sort of ripple of time. You know, here I am, maybe it was, you know, 2016, 2017, you know, at some kind of party chatting with this woman, and she mentions this, and then I have this flashback of being, you know, a little kid on Long Island. I don't know who this person was. All I recall was that it was sort of an obligatory, get your Barbies, you're going to go play with this kid. So maybe mm-hmm. she was new to the neighborhood, maybe, she, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as kids do, she brought out this doll in this exotic, seemed to be silk to me, a long dress with mm-hmm. pants. And all I didn't say, wow, where'd you get that? Oh, how interesting. Right. I just thought, I want one of those. It's not from the catalog. It's really gorgeous. So that was my in to the story of women on the periphery of these major events. So all I sat down initially was, I need to make up an origin story for a Barbie in an Ao Yai. And maybe subconsciously, yeah. You know how stories work, because I heard about this at a party. So mm-hmm. there's a party, and that's where she's going mm-hmm. to appear. So Barbie comes, again, nobody's thinking about the movie.
Right. Who knew?
Yeah, who right. knew? But the interesting thing, too, was, so this was Barbie in really her first iteration. Okay. Barbie was kind of a new thing. Mm-hmm. And she had not yet become the blonde
Barbie,
bimbo.
Right.
You know, in hot mm-hmm. pink. She was a teenage fashion model. Mm-hmm. And the little outfits that were in those yeah. original catalogs were Career Girl, you know, Sorority Girl, one I love, Southern Belle. So it was, I think, for that generation, really essentially my generation, it was this Barbie was this great release from baby dolls.
Right.
Because
right.
that's what you got. Does anybody remember? Betsy Wetsy. How much fun is this going to be? Here's a doll. You can just change its diapers constantly. Put it in a stroller. Right. Walk it up and down. And here was a doll who could be all these things. So.
Right.
So in some ways, Barbie was also a way into mm-hmm. that first little disturbance in the air that there's a new generation of women coming to the fore, mm-hmm. and they're not being told that they're stupid by their Barbies. They're being mm-hmm. told, you can imagine yourself as anything within restrictions.
Right. That's amazing. Okay. Digging down a little bit here, what was that conversation like with your agent or editor when you all realized what was happening this
the
past
movie.
Summer with the movie? Like, did somebody call somebody and say, did you just see?
Yeah, I think it was kind of, can you believe all this is happening with Barbie?
Right.
You know? Yeah, it was certainly, it was way, way, way before that... That Barbie had her place in my novel. And I have to confess, I haven't seen the movie yet. All the people I would least expect to love it.
Yeah. We have to take you to the movie. And we also have to get this book in Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig's hands. If it's not already, because I know
other,
that they would
the other
love
side
it.
Of the story.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. So... I'm really fascinated by your choices in terms of the narration in this book. Mm-hmm. Trisha narrates the book retrospectively. She's telling a story that happened many years ago. Mm-hmm. And she's narrating the story to a girl named Rainey, who mm-hmm. she knew as a young girl. And now
one who has the Barbie doll.
The one who has the Barbie. And she has remet when Rainey is grown up.
Right.
And Rainey is the grown-up daughter of another one of the women, the wives in Vietnam, mm-hmm. Named Charlene. Many books are told retrospectively. And sometimes books are told like this to an audience of one. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the narrative games that you've played here, switching from first-person direct address to a first-person narrator who refers to Rainey in third person. Mm-hmm. An example of this is at the very beginning. The little girl posed so prettily with her parents and her baby brother was you. She was about 7 or 8 in her Sunday best, like the rest of us, a crisp yellow dress, nearly gold, with pleats at the bodice, scalloped collar, and sleeves. She held a Barbie doll in the crook of her arm like a scepter. It must have been the first Barbie doll I've ever seen. So in that passage, we go from the little girl posed so prettily with her parents and her baby brother was you. Mm-hmm. And then the you becomes a she.
Right.
And it's magical. It's really not done like that in other books. Mm-hmm. It's alchemy. It does so many things to the reader's mind and to the story you tell, which I think almost... it's like silk folds on over itself. It's stunning. And I just love to hear you talk about it. Is it something that just happened? Is it a choice you made when you saw it on the page? Were you like, I should correct this? No, I shouldn't correct this. This is perfection. This is a new thing. I just love to hear you talk about
That's
it.
That's a great question. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're getting into craft.
Oh,
now.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, yes.
Yeah, there were two things I knew immediately starting this novel, and that doesn't mean that happens with every novel. Sometimes you don't know anything at all,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Or sometimes you think you know everything, and then the novel tells you you don't as you're composing. But I think I understood, and again, this may have arisen out of my own experience chatting with women of that generation, women sort of between my mother's generation and my own. I knew almost intuitively from the start that Patricia, this narrator who's looking back through her life at this particular time, needs to be invited to tell her story. Mm. she would not write a memoir because she thought her life was so interesting. She would certainly not grab anybody by the collar and say, let me tell you my Saigon stories. So I knew someone had to ask her. And since it was, I knew immediately, I didn't want to write As It Happens, 1963, Vietnam. That's been done. but that is retrospective and that it is memoir. I knew that someone had to evoke her memories and say, I'm listening. So that question that she's asked by Rainey all these years later is not in the first pages of the book. The book begins with her response, but it's in the silence before the novel begins. The question is, do you remember me? Do you remember my mother? Do you remember Dominic, who was a GI? I'm stepping out of our current world and saying, do you remember me? And so this is her answer. And in many ways, that first set piece, and it is a set piece, this is when I first saw you. You asked me, do I remember you? My first thought is, I remember the first day we met, and I met your mother, and I met your family. And in some way, I think that switch to third person is almost akin in prose to looking at a photograph, because it is a set piece. Mm-hmm. And memory sometimes works like that. Mm-hmm. Everything that happened before and after, how we got there, what day of the week it was. Trisha talks a lot about I didn't keep a diary, so everything's a little fungible. Mm-hmm. But I remember this moment. I remember looking up and seeing your family, your mother with the baby, your father, and you with that Barbie doll. And it is that a photograph is kind of always third person, you know. So it was that back and forth between memory and direct address. I mean, it's not, she gives her a very, very, very long answer. You know? Do you remember me? Yeah, 200 pages, so I remember you. You know? So it is kind of a play, not exactly a letter, but a play between memoir and those kind of set pieces / photographs that define our lives as we look back.
Well, you're always inventing and reinventing in your books. And I really feel like with that, you invented a new way to do this magical thing. It really struck me. And I, different places in the book where I found it, I kept looking, like, oh, there it is again. I just loved it. You've chosen as a narrator a woman in a faraway place, far from home, who is having trouble bearing children. Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of a central motif in the book. It sort of rises and falls at different times. And, you know, we really become very invested in Trisha's yearning and longing for children. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that and that choice and how that happened in the book and your thoughts about it.
Yeah. Again, you know, a woman coming of age in the 50s, she's 23 years old in 1963, only married a year. She has a husband. She's working class from Yonkers in New York, Irish Catholic. People are saying, oh, it's so different for you. You're set this novel in Saigon. That's fabulous. And I'm like, what? I brought an Irish Catholic girl to Saigon. You know? Did you notice it's the same characters I'm always writing about? You know, she got on the subway, she got off at Saigon. I don't know. You know? So she's, you know, again, this year of 1963, and no way I'm the first person to notice it, but it does fascinate me as on the precipice of so much change. You know, 63, early in the decade, you know, by 73, think of how much had changed in all different ways, in all over the world, in many countries, especially our own. So here was a woman on the rise because her husband is a lawyer. He is an engineer and is a lawyer, and he's with Navy Intelligence, and that's why they're in Saigon. And her role is help meet. Maybe I should just read that.
Sure.
Up to that word. Because I've had a couple of people say, was it a misprint? Did you mean help mate? I say, no, it's an archaic word, but people used it. So, let me just, this is just the opening pages. Tricia answering the question that's not actually in the book. There were so many cocktail parties in those days, and when they were held in the afternoon, we called them garden parties, but they were cocktail parties nonetheless. You have no idea what it was like for us, the women, I mean, the wives. Most days I would bathe in the morning and then stay in my housecoat until lunch, reading, writing letters home, those fragile, pale blue airmail letters with their complex folds, evidence, I think now, of how exotic distance itself once seemed. I'd do my nails, compose the charming bread and butter notes we were always exchanging, wedding stationery with my still new initials, real ink and cunning turns of phrase, bits of French, exclamation marks galore, the fan moving overhead and the heat encroaching even through the slatted blinds of the shaded room, the spice of sandalwood from the joss stick on the dresser. Out for a luncheon or a lecture or a visit to the crowded market, and then another bath when I woke from my afternoon nap, damp hair on my neck as I removed the shower cap, a haze of talcum. Still wrapped in the towel, I could feel the perspiration prick my skin. Face powder, rouge, lipstick, and then the high-waisted cotton underpants. I hope you're laughing. The formidable cotton bra, the panty girdle with the shining diamond of brighter elastic at its center, the click of the garters, stocking slipped over the hand and held up to the light, reinforced toe and heel and top. We were careful to secure the garter just so. Too close to the nylon, wrist a run. You cannot imagine the troubles suggested in those days by a stocking with a run. The woman was drunk, careless, unhappy, indifferent to her husband's career, even to his affections, ready to go home. Slip, then sheath, small white dress shields pinned under each arm with tiny gold safety pins, then shoes, jewelry, a spray of perfume. I would be faint with the heat in my column of clothes by the time I came downstairs. Peter, my husband, waiting, newly shaved, handsome in his tropical weight suit, white shirt and thin tie, having a first drink and looking a little wilted himself. And the girls we passed on the street or who met us at the door, who only moved across my inner eye by then in their white aoyais, were like pale leaves stirring in the humid stillness, sunstruck indications of some unseen breeze, cool, weightless, beautiful. It was at a garden party on a Sunday afternoon early in our first month in Saigon. The party was in the elegant courtyard of a villa not far from the basilica, a lovely street lined with tamarind trees. We'd only been there a few minutes ourselves when I turned to see a young family paused at the entrance, posed as if for a pretty picture beneath a swag of scarlet bougainvillea. Baby boy in the arms of the slim mother, daughter at her side, tall father in a pale suit, another engineer, I learned later. It was much later still, decades later, that I suddenly wondered, laughing to think about it, why so many engineers were needed. I was 23 then, with a bachelor's from Marymount. For a year before my marriage, I had taught kindergarten at a parish school in Harlem, but my real vocation in those days, my aspiration, was to be a helpmeet for my husband. That was the word I used,
It was, in fact, the word my own father had used, taking both my gloved hands in his as we waited for the wedding guest to file into our church in Yonkers. This was in the bride's waiting room, a small chamber well off the vestibule. I recall a tiny stained glass window, a kneeling bench for last-minute prayer, I suppose, a box of tissues for last-minute tears on a shelf under an ornate mirror, and two brocade chairs where we sat. The cool odor of old stone and the fresh flowers in my bouquet. My father took both my hands and held them together on the wide tulle skirt of my wedding dress, which even in the dim light of the tiny room was winking with seed pearls. He said, "Be a helpmeet to your husband. Be the jewel in his crown." I said, "I will." So, not more than a year later in Saigon, her main job, which is to have children, does not become the easy thing she thought it was at that moment. And that difficulty is the thing that bonds the women together, because it certainly is not something that the men want to know anything right. about in this time and place.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it also catalyzes her on her sort of disrupted journey, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if she were successful having children, then she'd be busy with her children.
Right.
Especially since she'd be pregnant and they'd be infants, maybe not. But because she's not busy with them, she gets busy with other things.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Hmm.
When you were reading that, which was such a treat for us to hear, it made me think of my next question, which is, could you talk to us a little bit about your research? Uh-huh. Because, oh my goodness, the description of the clothes, and it's all so specific, and we feel like we're right there with her, and we're sweaty too. And I know that finding all those perfect period details is no easy task. Could you talk to us about your research?
Sure. Well, you have done the same.
And, I love finding just the right detail.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that's what it takes. You know, it's you don't want to call so much attention to something that it feels like an artifact. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful line, and I can't quote it exactly. It's in Vladimir Nabokov's marvelous memoir, Speak Memory. And just to paraphrase it terribly, he talks about, you know, when you see an ordinary object in a museum under a glass, you know, this is the spoons they used, you know. It has this magical aura, although it's just an ordinary thing. And Nabokov talks about how it's the writer's obligation to make the reader see even the ordinary things with that shimmer of fascination and magic that it will be seen 200-400 years from now. And I sort of love that. And I think that that's the idea of finding just that right, especially if it's an object, a piece of clothing, without making it feel extraordinary, so that it's the material of the people living in this time and place. Mm-hmm. So research. I think this is something I'm sure you have been through, too. You know, research is very seductive.
Very seductive.
Very seductive. Yes. And the internet has just made it even more seductive. You don't have to go to libraries anymore and look up microfilm. And you can spend lots of time and feel like a real writer, looking for some little bit of information and not write a single sentence for weeks and weeks on.
Yep.
So having learned that lesson early and having stumbled upon novels that everything suddenly stops and you get all this information and you're like, I know, this has nothing to do with the story, but the writer found it and is putting this in the story whether it belongs or not. Isn't this interesting? Wikipedia, look at that. So I know I'm very careful not to do research until I have voice. Mm-hmm. Until I have some sense of the characters, some sense of what the story is going to be, and if while I'm first learning that, there's something I need to look up, I take a guess.
Yep.
But don't stop. Get, especially voice, you have to understand who's speaking in the reader's ear, who's speaking in your ear, and how you're going to manipulate that. So I'd already begun the novel, this pre-COVID, and I thought, I guess I'm going to have to go to Vietnam. That's great, because I really always wanted to go to Vietnam, and now I can go at doing research. it's a tax deduction. You know? But then, of course, COVID came along, and I realized very quickly, you know, Saigon literally is no longer on the map. And Saigon in 1963 is not a place I can visit.
Right.
It is indeed a place I can only imagine. Mm-hmm. So what I did through the first lockdown summer was just go to my shelves and read every Vietnam book that I love, starting with the novels, obviously, and all of Tim O'Brien's work, Robert Stone. Tree of Smoke was really great, just to not knowing what I was looking for, but the way a novel can mm-hmm. sort of suck you into time and place in a way that's almost more vivid than experience. So I just sort of immersed myself, and then I moved on to some of the more political books, Bright Shining Lie and Road Not Taken, and then some of the more things that Mary McCarthy, for instance, had a series of essays when she visited Vietnam. Most of them, of course, were once the war had really mm-hmm. started. So it was sort of I had to kind of imagine backwards to, 1963, when there wasn't quite the awareness of how terrible things mm-hmm. were going. But just using that and hoping somehow if you absorb it enough and you find enough good writers who can describe place and give you that sense of having been there, then when I was with my own characters, what I needed would come to me. Mm-hmm. You know, so yeah. then you can do the fine-tuning,
right,
as you
right,
know.
Right.
Check the internet, look at look mm-hmm. at contemporaneous. I've been reading the New York Times from June 1963. Mm-hmm. What kind of language did we use? How did we talk about Vietnam? Mm-hmm. And looking at dresses and hairstyles and trying to get over the astonishment of they were wearing stockings in Saigon when it was 100 degrees.
Can you imagine?
No. Hairspray? Yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah. And rollers when it's so hot? Women had to do this? Is that crazy? And it seems crazy. And then, there it is.
Were there moments where doing your research, then led to making story happen? Like, were there things you learned that then became part of Trish's journey? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's also really interesting. A couple of things. I don't know if it was so much the research. Actually, it was more the research that I had done for my previous novel, The Ninth Hour, that in some ways guided story. Mm-hmm. Of course, I knew I was, in some way doing a response to The Quiet American. But, if you're writing about innocence abroad, it's also like, always at my back I hear Joseph Conrad, mm-hmm. and E.M. Forster, and so I knew that these women were at some point had to be headed into a kind of heart of darkness, mm-hmm. In their own way,
yes.
not in the war story way, right. But in their own way, through their efforts to do good, they had to confront something. Yeah. And when I was researching The Ninth Hour, I read about... There are lots of nuns in The Ninth Hour, and I read about many orders. I made up my own order, but I wanted to make sure that it was close to other orders that actually existed. And one of the things that I read that I made mention of it but didn't use was an order of nuns from Syracuse, New York, who went to Hawaii to work with the lepers.
Oh, wow, Hawaii.
Yes, Father Damien gets all the credit, but actually Mother Marianne Cope did a lot more. And there was a call for, that there was a need for women to go and help in the leper colony in Molokai. And she was the only one who volunteered with a small group. And the thing I love, and this is not in either book because you can't make this stuff up. She told her nuns before they left that she would guarantee them that none of them would ever contract leprosy. And they never did. None of them. And they worked with the lepers to the end of their lives, but they all died natural deaths. But one thing that I read about Mother Mary Ann Cope that I just loved was that she was very fashionable. And she got to the leper colony and she said, we have to have nice clothes for these people, especially for the women. And she taught them crafts so that they could decorate their rooms because they have to have beauty. We're here to take care of their physical needs, sure, and to help them through their suffering and their journey, you know, inevitably to death. But in the meantime, they need beauty. And I loved that. So suddenly, Charlene is throwing out, you know, we're making these little Barbie doll clothes to make money. And just sort of impulsively, she tells the major's wife in the book, oh, yeah, and we're also going to make clothes for the lepers because we're going to bring clothes, beautiful silk ayayes. To the women in the leper colony here in Vietnam. So if I hadn't found that bit of research, I'm not sure Charlene would have impulsively decided to do that.
I love that. And that's such a compelling and important part of the book. And something I noticed is that I was really stricken by how, and I'm not like giving anything away here because this isn't like a plot point, but the book ends back with those nuns who are helpmeets, right?
Yes.
And they are helpmeets who stay in Vietnam. And I found that to be a really striking choice, that staying with me with the book, that we end back with those nuns and the silk pillowcases they're going to make for them. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little? Was that always the ending? When you found that ending, were you like, this is it? Or was that something that happened in editing? Like, if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think what happened, and again, probably there's a parallel between what happened to me composing the novel and what happened to Tricia as the narrator. This, you know, something of the confessional in any memoir. So when you're asked, do you remember me? Do you remember my mother? Do you remember Dom? What was it like then? I think she begins with what she knows she's going to say. But in the course of telling what it was like then, she begins to tell things she didn't know she was going to reveal or discover about herself. This is why her initial response is longer, I think, than Rainey would have expected, because she, in the telling, and this is the beauty of storytelling, she's discovering parts of the story she didn't know were there. Mm. And I think that's the end, that's the final. She tells her part and still is pretty much in control. There are a few places where that stuff she didn't think she was going to say get in. But then it's like, oh, okay, oh, I told you. So that was the story. What about you? Mm-hmm. And Rainey tells her, from her perspective, talks about her mother, her life after, you know, being a child in Saigon. And she stumbles on a few confessional things that I think she didn't mean to say. And I think that then elicits the second letter from Tricia. Mm-hmm. You've told me something.
Yeah.
Now I must tell you what I didn't plan to tell you from the start.
Uh-huh. Amazing. Wonderful, beautiful. Well, I've gotten the little signal over there that it is now time for questions from our lovely audience.
Listening to you read in particular, it's apparent that you have a meter to the language that you're using. And I wonder when you're writing if you have an experience of hearing the words as you're writing, which seems evident when I listen to you read.
Thank you. Yeah, I think when we talk about voice, there is the musicality of it and rhythm in any given sentence, in any given paragraph, the rhythm of a page, the rhythm of a chapter. And that's really important to me because I think that's the thing that we writers can claim nobody else can do.
You know?
You can't capture that in film, even with a voiceover. you can't get that kind of sustained rhythm and musicality. And it's the thing that I love poetry and fiction for the most, or any good writing, you know, that sense of language is being used fully. And that's really important to me, to get that sound. There's a wonderful thing that Eudora Welty used to say. She kind of put it in, again, a much more eloquent Southern way, but it's like, you know, you're kind of cooking as a writer when you hear the sound of the next sentence before you've chosen the words. You know, and when you read something, you get caught up in that. As a reader, you understand. And it relates to another wonderful thing that I love that I was always having my students read was an Isaac Dinesen story called The Blank Page. And in this story, there's a storyteller who says that if the storyteller is true to the story, then at the end of the story, the silence speaks more eloquently than any storyteller can. And that idea that you get to the end of a chapter or a story or a poem or a novel and the silence speaks. And I think you have to have that musicality and that rhythm established in order to make that happen. Language is marvelous. It's abused constantly, but it's marvelous.
Hello, I have many questions, but I'll try to limit it. I wonder, over the course of your career, how have you evolved as a writer, and what's the role of your editor, and is that a person or a team that you have the same group over time, so they say, like, yes, this is Alice's voice. Well, actually, no, that doesn't sound, you know, so has it all evolved in a certain fashion, and are you, like, noticing now what you write about and the way you write is some culmination of where you began, or what's the sort of longer-term perspective?
Wow, that's a great question. Thank you. I'm sort of rare in publishing today. I've had the same editor since I had the first 100 pages of my first novel.
That is just astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't happen anymore. We've grown up together. and we sometimes joke it's like a long marriage. Sometimes we just don't even hear each other, And the reason he is my editor, when I only had 100 pages of my first novel, the agent that I was sent to by someone I had studied with when I was getting my master's said to me, the first person I want to show these 100 pages to is Jonathan Galassi, because he's a brilliant editor, but he won't get in your way. And you're young, and you haven't finished it yet, And honestly, if I had gone to an editor who said, okay, and now the vampire shows up, I probably would have said, oh, yeah, I can do that. next chapter, yeah. So that's kind of been the refrain from our working relationship. He doesn't get in my way. He's always assuring me, you know this book better than anyone. You know your intentions better than anyone. Just stick to them. You know, don't be afraid of them. So we have had developed this working relationship. I pretty much just show him as I'm going along, or sometimes I take a long time and don't show him. And he's the first person who reads my work. Nobody else. Well, my agent will also read it, but he's the first person I ask for a response. And he has a light hand. You know, mostly it's questions that I have for him. Like, does this make any sense? You know, should I throw this away? And he's very smart. We don't have the same taste. There are so many novels that he absolutely loves that don't speak to me, and vice versa. So it's really sort of interesting. So it's not a passionate reading. It's a very cool reading that he gives my work, which I'm grateful for, because that's the first thing you want. You don't want anyone saying, oh, no, this is great. And you're like, no, I have a list of all the things I think are wrong. Now tell me, am I right or not? So that's pretty much how we work. Now, of course, copy editing and all that, over the years, that's changed tremendously. There have been different people doing it. And there's a sort of a young cohort of copy editors now who are wonderful, but you know, they're not the grammar ladies that I recall from my first couple of novels that scared the hell out of you because they knew everything there was to know about semicolons, you know. But there's another way that copy editors now approach work. Of course, they're very careful about offending, you know, language, archaic language or language that maybe we don't, you know, make it clear that this is coming from the character, make it clear that this is from another era, a kind of sensitivity that didn't exist, obviously, you know, 30 years ago. So, and I appreciate that. I you know, just that careful attention to word choice with all its ramifications, not just its grammatical ramifications. And I think that's a good thing. I don't see that as censorship or confining in any way. I think it's a good thing because, again, it's just a reminder of the power of language in a single word, and the slightly better word can make all the difference.
I have another one, if nobody's going to go. I know I already, like, had my fill, but could you talk to us just a smidge about the title?
Yes, sure, yeah. So here's the backstory of the title. I had a very dear friend, unfortunately. He passed away in May. He was a Monsignor in a parish in Queens, also taught at a couple of Catholic universities in New York, studied literature at Columbia as a young man. When he died, he was 97. One of the smartest, loveliest people I've encountered, a truly spiritual man, funny, read everything, saw every play on Broadway, off Broadway, just marvelous. Anyway, about two summers ago, I had dinner with him, and he said, you know, do you have a title for the book that you're working on? And I said, well, yeah, you're a good person to have. I'm thinking of calling it Absolution. And he's a very big guy, and he kind of gave me it. And he said, that's a terrible title. I was somewhat taken aback, and I said, really? And he said, yes, because so few people understand what it means. Mm-hmm. And then he went on to talk about this whole thing about forgiving. And the thing that it was brilliant and a wonderful exegesis on confession and penance. But the thing that really convinced me, he said that the Latin root for the word absolution translates to be set free. And Monsignor George pointed out that to be set free always involves two. There's the person who is set free and the person who sets free. You can't have, there is no solitary absolution. It always involves two. And by that time, I was far enough along in the novel that I was well aware of how much twinning and duality there is in this novel. There are literally twins. There are cousins, Vietnamese cousins, who were raised together as if they were twins. There's female friendship. Every character has some kind of, there's all kinds of dualities. So when he said that, it's like, oh, sorry, no, now you just convinced me. You know? Of course, he said, well, you're absolved. You didn't, you know? But I think the it goes back to this call and response between these two women looking back at their past to not to say, and this was Monsignor George's point, not to say we're going to pretend that never happened, we're just going to wipe the slate clean. It is to know completely what happened and to say, in spite of that, I know the context, I understand you, I see what happened, I see what you were thinking. Your intentions were good, but the result was a disaster. But once I understand that about you, once you ask me to understand that about you, then I can grant you. But it takes that exchange, mm-hmm. Not a confession spoken into the dark, but one to the other, here's what I did, and someone else saying, I see what you did. I understand its ramifications and its wrongness, but I set you free of that. I don't erase it. I set you free. So it became absolution. Plus, one of my favorite short stories was F. Scott Fitzgerald's story, Absolution. Wonderful, wonderful short story that Fitzgerald initially was going to make the first chapter of The Great Gatsby. And I think it was Maxwell Perkins who told him to cut it out. If he had opened The Great Gatsby with that chapter rather than the one, he would have been called a Catholic novelist, and none of us would know anything about his work, except a few Jesuits. So I always thought, you know, Absolution is a great short story and it's a good name, but thank God he didn't make it the first chapter of The Great Gatsby.
Wow. That's wonderful. Let us give a huge round of applause for Alice.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.